Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Thank you very much to Pascal. She'll be back at 11:30 with the headlines. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Consuming Issues on Share Radio, making that pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Now, this is Money. This is the time to discuss the financial issues that affect you with Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money, and members of his team of investigative reporters from the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Well, on behalf of us, the consumer, they investigate everything from scams, bad banks, as well as how to keep costs down and what are the best deals out there. Well, Simon is joined today by one of his journalists, Lee Boyce. Welcome, you two.
Good morning.
Hi, Georgie.
We've been also asking today, we've got plenty coming up, so let's talk about that. There's a huge mobile phone scam that you're going to be telling us a lot more about. Plus, you've been having a chat with TV property guru Sarah Beeny, big fan of hers. Now, we've also been asking today, and it means I'm going to have to ask you guys too. Scientists in the US reckon they've developed a new lens which allows 3D objects to become invisible. Not sure if you've been investigating this story or not. The research author says the technology could be scaled up. I won't bore you with the tech details, mostly because I don't understand them. However, it does mean that apparently we are a step closer to having an invisibility cloak like the one in Harry Potter. Apparently. So we're asking today, of course, if you had a cloak of invisibility, where would you go and what would you do? I imagine as journalists, you'd have some fun with this. Simon?
Well, it's a very difficult question, isn't it? Because you've got to be very careful with your answer here, don't you? What would you really do with an invisibility cloak?
I thought you were a journalist, not a politician.
No, no.
Come on, Simon.
So I did come up with one answer, which was that I could use it to sneak away from my children when they're demanding things. But actually, what I would do is I'm a snowboarder and I would use it to cut to the front of lift queues. So I'd sneak up to the front of the chairlift, jump on first, with
practical,
my visibility cloak on.
Practical, and your kids don't feel terribly neglected now, so well done.
I might even take them with me.
Lee, what would you do?
It's a bit of a boring one, but I think I'd just wander around London and sort of blend into the background and see what people are up to without, you know, being scowled at and shouted at on the tube and all that sort of stuff.
Banging the drum for London tourism here.
You know what I mean? It'd be nice just to blend into the background and enjoy it rather than...
I know exactly what you mean. I do know. I thought about that one. Annie, how can people get in contact and what have they been saying?
Okay, so you can tweet us at Share Radio UK. Email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. Call us on 020-338-49849 or leave us a message on our Facebook page. Well, Kelly said that she would love to follow around Brad Pitt for the day. There's no explanation needed on that one. And Andy says that I would travel for free on the Underground. Without getting harassed or shouted at, and then get himself down to Heathrow, pass through customs within seconds, and then board a first-class flight to the Bahamas.
Now let's look at some of the stories that have been making the headlines then, Lee and Simon. The news that's been breaking overnight, and this is UKIP has its second elected MP in Westminster after, of course, Mark Reckless won the Rochester and Strood by-election in Kent. Your thoughts on that, Simon?
Well, I think the thing about UKIP is that it is genuinely shaking up Britain's political scene. You know, they are actually a threat and they are taking voters off the main parties. But where this comes in from a money angle and a consumer angle is that it's pushing us further towards the suggestion that we need to have a referendum on leaving the EU. Mm-hmm. And businesses don't really like the idea of us leaving the EU. There's a lot of, you know, companies that operate here because we're their base in Europe, and you do need to be careful about that. But some people are very unhappy with the way that we impose laws from Brussels and also with the amount of control that comes from there. Mm-hmm. And there is a big support from people in business, actually, not for leaving the EU, but some form of renegotiation of where we stand in the relationship with it.
Is that likely to happen?
I mean, he's promised a referendum. So, you know, I think that with a referendum, I think people would probably vote to stay in the EU. But I don't know, it could be closer than you think. Well, as we found out with the Scottish referendum, as for some form of renegotiation, I think that's highly likely. And I also think it's probably likely with some of the European countries. So if you look at countries like Italy, for example, mm-hmm. which has gone nowhere since it joined the euro, it's got a problem with a large amount of debt. And the way it used to deal with periods of slow growth is devalue the currency. Everything would take off again because it's a great manufacturing and design nation. And then it'd be on the up and then things would go down again. And it'd do it again. Hasn't been able to do that since it joined the euro. There's a lot of people in Italy, for example, asking, what has the euro done for us? And I don't think that that eurozone problem has gone away at all.
Lee, your thoughts?
Well, I think, echo what Simon says there, but it's almost like Labour, Conservatives, you know, people were looking for something that offers a little bit of difference. It feels like, you know, we had the Labour government in, sort of trailed off towards the end, and they had to deal with sort of the financial crisis and all that sort of stuff. But new government in, all these austerity measures, so people feeling the pinch. And I think, you know, UKIP and sort of the Green Party as well, I don't think we should discount the sort of support that they're starting to gather.
Well, they came
as well.
Fourth, didn't they, in front of the Liberal Democrats. What they must be feeling, licking wounds this morning.
Exactly. So, you know, and I just think people, it's almost like, not a protest vote, I don't think that's the correct thing to say, but people
we can't
are,
really look at it like a protest vote
people
anymore.
No, people are just looking at something different and what other parties can, you know, bring to the plate. And that's something that's never really been about before. So it's a very interesting time, and the general election will be interesting 6 months' time.
It will be indeed. Well, Tory defector Mark Reckless claimed afterwards that it showed the party can win across the country next May for the general election before he joined leader Nigel Farage in a pub.
I was really pleased with my majority. It was what I was hoping for. We achieved it, and I think it's a solid basis to fight the general election.
Well, there he is in a pub. But David Cameron says their hold on the constituency will be short-lived.
This result was closer than the forecasters predicted, and I want to congratulate Kelly Tolhurst on such a positive and strong campaign. And let me say, I'm absolutely determined to win this seat back at the next general election.
Well, he won it with a near majority, 3,000 majority, over his old party. But Joe Twyman from the pollsters YouGov actually said the result was probably not as good as UKIP had expected.
Perhaps one or two Tory MPs who were maybe thinking about defecting and seeing how this result went will probably now sit on their hands and think, no, it's not worth it, because I don't think this is a large enough victory to ensure that that he keeps the seat at the general election.
Another very interesting political story that came out from last night, Simon and Lee, before we move on, was the accusations of snobbery about Labour's shadow Attorney General resigning that have led to that. Emily Thornberry quit after a backlash to a tweet that she posted showing a white van outside a house draped in England flags in Rochester and Strood. It caused embarrassment for her party. Shadow Foreign Secretary Douglas Alexander insists that Labour does still speak for the working people.
I think Emily Thornberry has paid the price, because in politics perception matters, and what we've got to do over the coming months is to show, in terms of the practical policies that we're offering, that we have solutions to the kind of real anger and grievance that many people across the country feel.
Simon?
Well,
As a journalist,
I would advise anybody in the public eye to be very careful about what they tweet, because you tweet something now and it's a story. But the other thing I would say, actually, about this is it does give a little bit of an insight into politics and politicians. And I can understand, actually, why there's a bit of a storm about this, because Emily Thornberry is the MP for Islington South.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Islington North. Islington South is the bit that makes up from Upper Street down into the city and Finsbury. Now, that's an area that in the last decade or so has been colonised by wealthy people, bankers, lawyers, etc. But that's an area that originally had a lot of working class people living in it, and they're being squeezed out by higher prices on rents and house prices and being moved out by those who are wealthier. And actually, quite a lot of that area is classic white van with an England flag territory.
I'll go back to what we were saying, you know, about the tweet. I just think that politicians, they have to have some sort of safety button in their head when they're tweeting something. They know that it's going to be picked up by press that are frothing at the mouth to do something that is going to shed them in a bad light. So really, she's got to think to herself, is this a good tweet? Should I really be putting this? I don't know what it's really adding to anything. So in that regard, you know, it's a silly thing to do. Do they represent this anymore? Well, it's a tough question that I can't really answer it.
I suppose we'll stick with the political bent then. Public borrowing figures are out this morning. The government borrowing fell to $7.7 billion in October. That's according to official figures, down $0.2 billion from a year earlier. Simon?
Well, it's actually slightly better than it was a year ago. But the concern is that George Osborne is basically not going to hit his targets for this year. And it's almost cast iron certainty that he's not going to. I mean, this isn't so bad that he's going to have to stand up and give his awesome statement wearing his invisibility cloak.
Oh, very good. But... very, very good. Just a reminder, the target was 10%, he said it would come down by in March, and it's gone down 2.4%, so we're very unlikely.
So you're quite a long way from that target. And the reason behind this is basically weak tax receipts. Mm. He expected better tax receipts than this, and quite a bit of that's coming from income tax. And the idea was that wages would be rising by more than they are at the moment, and we'd be getting more income tax in, and they're not. And one of the things that comes into play in that is slow wage growth, but also more lower-paid jobs and a large number of people in self-employment. So that's weakening the amount of money coming into the government. So whilst we hear a lot about how the economy is raging ahead and doing very well, and we might be questioning why interest rates aren't going up if things are so good, actually, when you look at some of these figures, this is the reason behind it. It's not doing quite as well as everyone thinks.
And I guess the worry for us with an election coming up, with George Osborne talked about eliminating this by the deficit by 2020, looks quite unlikely, but it does mean more austerity measures to come.
Cuts, yes, more cuts. It's very difficult to really sort of take a strong position on where you stand with this argument, because there are two sides to this. There is the fact that we have been spending too much money, mm-hmm. and wasting quite a lot of money going back, you know, over the past decade or so. But then there's the argument that by cutting, you are undermining the economy, and actually you need to usher in a little bit of looser policy so that there's more money flowing into the economy from the government and keeping the economy running along. Now, George Osborne's plan, when the Tories came into power, was that by this point the private sector would be picking up the slack and it would be dealing with this problem for the government, and so the government wouldn't need to be spending all this money. And that's not happened, and a lot of that goes back to that problem of people having too much debt when the financial crisis hit, so people are cutting back and worried about taking on more debt, mm-hmm. and consumer spending, and also this problem of low wages. So it's difficult to see what the exact right answer is.
Lee, you were nodding along there.
Well, I just think also, being a bit London-centric, you know, we look around here and everything's looking rosy, really. I mean, most people have jobs in this area. But there was a programme on earlier in the week on Channel 4 from Fraser Nelson, who's the editor of Spectator, and they went sort of into some deprived areas, you know, council estates and that sort of stuff. And people are struggling, you know, the wages aren't going up. A lot of people were, you know, taking jobs, but they're on these zero-hour contracts. And, you know, I just think sometimes we need to look at the bigger picture. You know, if there's more austerity measures around the corner, how's it going to hit people across the country? And it's going to be pretty, pretty brutal, I guess.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now, this is Moneys. This is the time to discuss the financial issues that affect you with Simon Lambert, the editor of This Is Money, and journalist Lee Boyce. They are from the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Now, the first story that we're going to cover today is a pretty shocking mobile phone scam that's said to be worth £3.5 billion. Simon, just tell us what this is about.
This is an expose by one of our colleagues on the newspaper, on the Daily Mail, Ruth Live. And we carried this week, and it's a really, really good story. Basically, what's happening is thieves are stealing mobile phones and then racking up huge bills. Mm-hmm. So you lose your mobile phone on a night out, or you think you've misplaced it. So you don't call up because you think, oh, well, I left it there and I could probably get it back from there. By the time you get it back in the morning, you discover that hundreds or thousands of pounds have been rung up on your phone. Now, we've been reporting on this issue for a number of years and calling on the mobile phone companies to do more about it. But the one thing that was always not quite clear was what is being done with these phones? Where are these huge bills coming from? Why are people spending 9 hours on the phone to Nigeria? Who wants to speak to their family for 9 hours on the phone?
Oh, Simon.
But what this has looked at is that how this is happening. And how this is happening is that actually the fraudsters are calling premium rate numbers overseas in foreign countries. Mm-hmm. And once they connect, it starts racking up the charges. The fraudster gets a cut. The premium rate operator over there, which is essentially a fraudulent premium rate line over there, they're making money from it. And the person losing money is you, who've lost your phone. Now, the mobile phone companies have ultimately, in most cases, and this is why we've heard from a lot of readers who've been hit by this, washing their hands of it and saying, well, you didn't report your phone stolen, therefore we're not responsible, you have to pay this bill. And what this story is looking at is, where's that money going? Why is it happening? And saying, why are the mobile phone companies not doing more about this?
How much are people racking up? How much, what are the worst you've seen?
Well, we've seen cases where people racked up thousands of pounds.
Thousands of pounds.
Thousands of pounds. So, you know, I've got one here that a headline says, I lost my phone on holiday and ended up with an £1,800 bill. There's someone in this article who rang up, who ended up with a £3,400 bill. And there's another bill here for more than £6,000. A victim was left with a £6,200 bill after their phone was stolen in Spain. It was used to make 369 calls over 30 hours to a Serbian premium rate number. If that is not a pattern of suspicious activity that should not be picked up by a mobile phone company on the basis that I'm imagining this person had probably never called Serbia before, I don't know what is. And this is the problem, is ultimately your mobile phone, it's kind of like a credit card or a bank account. It's a credit agreement. You're responsible for the money run up on that. Yet the mobile phone companies do not have the same responsibility that your bank does or your credit card company does if that card is stolen and you've not been negligent.
But the argument surely for the mobile phone companies is, well, you should have reported your phone missing.
That is very true. But many people don't even know that their phone is missing at this point. You know, it's not the case that people do constantly use their mobile phones, even in this day and age when you don't appear to be able to walk down the street without someone bumping into you because they're texting. But, you know, if someone loses it of an evening and then they come home and then they go to bed and they wake up in the morning, they think, where's my phone? And then they try and track it down. You could easily be looking at 12 hours, and that's without them delaying, you know.
Are there any cases where mobile phone companies have paid people back?
What we've found with some of the cases that we've investigated in the past, that when we have talked to the mobile phone companies and pushed them, you know, to try and help these people, that they have refunded some of the money or written off some of the bills. But the reason why those cases have landed on our desk is because the people have tried, the customers have tried to do it first of all, and they've got short shrift.
Calls for caps on costs have been ignored as well.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, this is something that was talked about being brought in, and me and Lee were talking about this earlier. Is there was this suggestion of a £50 cap that was going to be brought in, and it's theoretically been agreed, but it's just not been brought in.
I mean, suggested by the government last year.
Suggested by the government, and we have a quote here from the government, which is, a Department for Culture, Media and Sports spokesman says, mobile phone networks have agreed to cap bills for phones that have been reported lost or stolen. Details will be confirmed shortly. I'm sure that is a great deal of comfort to anyone who's been hit with a £6,000 bill.
How widespread is this? What can we do to protect ourselves against it, I suppose?
Well, I think first of all, talking about, again, what mobile operators should be doing, the places where this seems to be happening are in African countries, Pacific Islands. Now, I don't understand how, you know, if you took out an agreement, surely you could say, look, I don't ever call anywhere in Africa, or I don't call anywhere in the Pacific Islands. It's quite a you know, specific place to be calling. So I think if you're from that area and you say, you know, tick a box, yeah, I do make calls there, first, there needs to be something there. But it seems quite widespread, and a lot of it happens abroad. So if you're in sort of holiday mode, half of it happens abroad. And I think the danger is, people think if they haven't got the latest iPhone or Samsung Galaxy, they think their phone's not really a target. So you might have an old phone that's not worth much, but it is worth much if they steal it and then run up these rack up these costs. And if you are abroad, it's quite difficult to let your phone operator know because you don't have a phone anymore. So it makes it difficult.
So it's mostly then happening in tourist hotspots as opposed to, say, this country.
Well, I think half of it's happening abroad.
Right.
So, you know, some areas of Europe are rife for pickpockets. I think Barcelona and Rome, those sort of tourist hotspots. I would suggest that's probably where a lot of it's happening. And you were probably less likely to report your phone missing if you're abroad. You might go to say to yourself, well, I'll report it when I get home. What's the harm? Or it's really difficult for me to sort of, you know, we've got this book, we've got this tour booked, so I'll cancel it when we get back from this tour. So I think that, I don't know if they play up on that and they know that that's a fact in this, but what they're doing is the longer that they can keep these calls going for, you know, the more money they're going to rack up. So I think, yeah, being a tourist probably does make you quite a soft target.
Is there anything you can do?
Our readers do love
screen locks,
a page your own phone. So if you've got a pay-as-you-go phone, it's not a credit agreement. As we, you know, you don't have a direct debit, so to speak, so you're not just going to have the money taken out of your account. If you've got a £10 or £20 pay-as-you-go phone, that's probably not a bad idea, especially if you're going to go abroad. But in terms of screen locks, it doesn't actually help in this instance. So a lot of people have a password to get on the phone, or, you know, a pattern lock. But all fraudsters will do is just take the SIM card out and put it into another phone, because it's the SIM card that they need. That's what's linked to your phone number and your account. So, yeah, they can rack up calls that way.
I mean, we've got a couple of suggestions from readers, actually, in our reader comments on the story. I mean, we've got one from Ron H. in Bishop Auckland, who said, all new phones coming into this country should be premium line barred. When first registered, a code word should be given, and only the provision of that code word should allow premium lines to be unlocked. I mean, and then the other suggestion is that both the phone and the SIM card should be locked, so that you shouldn't be able to do that. Take the SIM card out, put it in another phone without entering in a PIN number or something, and that would obviously stop the situation where you think, yeah, I'm safe, got a PIN number, but you're not.
You've said two there. How much more response have you got there from
We had a stream of comments. One that says, you know, phone companies have only paid lip service to mobile theft. Phones that are stolen should be disconnected from the networks immediately. Which, I mean, to be fair, you know, once you call up and say it, that they probably are. But then, you know, you've got the classic pay-as-you-go argument. You know, why would anyone want a contract phone? My pay-as-you-go, bought in Tesco 12 years ago, cost me £40 a year. Use the web for everything else, which is free. That might be an isolated example. A lot of people rely on their contract phones, and I don't think suggesting everybody should ditch them for pay-as-you-go phones.
Well, I think if you're away on holiday, unless you're a businessman, you're not really going to make an awful amount of calls home, or hopefully not anyway. But, you know, it still makes you contactable if you're away. And a lot of people now will hook up to Wi-Fi in a hotel and use apps like WhatsApp, you know, to send messages home. So, yeah, I can kind of see it does work out more expensive. You're going to start making lengthy phone calls while you're away. But if you just need to be contactable for a week or so, then it's probably not a bad option.
It'd be great to think we could just all leave our mobile phones behind, but I can't think of anyone that would go, yeah.
That would be a wonderful thought.
Have there been any criminal prosecutions over this?
Not that I'm aware of, to be perfectly honest. I mean, the one thing that I do know is that I've got a string of stories here and a campaign that we launched in 2012 calling on the mobile phone companies to do something about this and demanding that customers were given a better deal. And it's now the sort of penultimate month of 2014, so nothing's been done.
What have they said to you?
Well, I mean, you know, ultimately the mobile phone companies say that they try and put some of the onus is on the customer to report their phone stolen. They say that they can't be held responsible for this, that the charges are being made by the overseas provider and they simply have to pay those charges. But actually, what's very interesting about this story, the expose that Ruth has done for Moneymail, is that she spoke to a former head of fraud at one of the mobile phone companies, and he said that there are instances, in many cases, where the mobile phone companies will actually be making a bit of a profit margin on these calls. So whilst they might have to hand over the money to the, you know, to the premium rate number, to the operator abroad, within that total charge, there is a slice that is profit. And what we have encountered in many of these cases is certainly not the companies offering to at least take that slice off.
Goodness. Well, if you've been affected by this, do get in contact with us. Annie, how can people get in contact?
So you can tweet us at Share Radio UK. You can email us at consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. You can call us on 020-33-849-849, or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page.
Before we turn our attention to the lovely Sarah Beeny, I have to ask Lee, what other scams have you been looking at this week?
There's been a real surge in scams in general in the last couple of months. And I know we've discussed a couple of weeks ago about phishing. That's a big one at the moment.
Just remind us what that is.
That is where fraudsters will hijack a phone line and portray to be from your bank, and they'll, you know, get your trust, and you know, customers will fall for it and think, that is my bank. Call back, so they'll say call back the number on your back of your bank card. They'll call up, but they'll stay on the line. Tens of thousands of pounds have been siphoned away, and as soon as it hits that fraudster's account, it gets split all around the world, and that's it. Banks struggle to trace it. Invoice fraud is another one that's been doing around the last couple of months, which is more of a business one, but fake invoices, basically. They look official. They look like a company that you deal with. I mean, these are like properly official stamped letters that look, you know, and some businesses will forfeit, you know, new bank details and set it up. And we're talking big sums of money there because it's small businesses and it's contracts. So there are a lot of scams out there. And the best thing to do is read This Is Money to keep up to date with them all, because there are loads coming through.
You've got him well
trained. That was a good plug, Lee. Well done.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Talking about plugs, I thought I'd get mine in there. Now on to our next story, which could potentially revolutionise the property market if it takes off. Now, traditionally, if you want to sell your home, you do it through an estate agent, right? And you expect to give them a hefty cut for the trouble. But unsurprisingly, in a digital age, a number of new online agents have launched in recent years, such as eMove, Hatched, and they all promise to save home sellers cash by cutting out the estate agent middlemen. Well, TV personality and property guru Sarah Beeny has come up with her own online agent. So, Simon, tell us a little bit more about that. You caught up with her, didn't you?
Well, actually, if I'm going to be entirely honest, it wasn't me who managed to catch up with Sarah
Beeny. No.
Much to the disappointment of my wife, because she loves watching Double Your House for Half the Money. It was actually Lee here. So I'll let him take the reins.
Yeah, so I met her for last week.
What was she like?
She's as lovely as she is on television.
Good.
Absolutely fantastic person. Really knows her onions. It was a very interesting chat. Now, we spoke a lot about online estate agencies and she owns one, so she obviously got that interest in the market and is always going to say that it's going to take off. I agree with her. I think there's going to be a market for online estate agents. You think a traditional estate agent will take a 1.5% fee, but that can be a lot higher, especially in London and the South East. The way that an online estate agent works is you pay a flat fee as opposed to a percentage fee. So you start from about £600 packages, and it's as simple as listing it online. So a lot of people now will window shop at Rightmove or Zoopla rather than an estate agent's window. You know, I think if you were on the hunt for a property, you'd look at one of those two websites, really, on the whole. So I think it plays up to that whole that whole new generation of people that search for homes that way. And it's as simple as that, really. I mean, it's almost like eBay, but for property.
Yeah, which, I mean, eBay generally works very well, but it generally works very well for the sort of smaller items. What you're talking about is something
it's the largest asset that you're going to sell. It's not going to be like a bidding process like that, but it's a shop window. So, you know, if I was looking for something quite obscure, I'd probably look on eBay and you'd find that object. But a lot of people want to window shop, and they want to window shop at, you know, 3 a.m. or something, you know, and they can do that via the internet. And that's what these services are starting to offer now.
But they can also do that with real life estate agents' websites. Most of them will have an estate. And isn't there something nice and to be said for having the security of dealing with a person face to face?
I mean, an estate agent will argue that the reason why you should use a traditional high street estate agent over an online agent is because they will get you more money for your property. They will simply say, this is our job. We are professionals. We know how to get the most amount of money. Whereas with an online agent, quite often you'll be showing people around the property yourself. They might do some of the negotiation for you, so you can opt for them to do the negotiating. So the potential buyer will call up the online agent. They'll do the negotiating for you. But the high street agent argues that they've got that professionalism and everything behind them. But the fact of the matter is that basically a high street estate agent can be 1.5%, but that's plus VAT, and up to, you know, 2 or 3%. If you're selling a £500,000 property, then you're looking at £10,000 to £15,000, which, if you can sell it for a flat fee of £600, including VAT, then you're going to save yourself an awful lot of money. So you have to weigh those two things up and think, well, is my property good enough to sell itself, and am I happy with selling my property and potentially doing some of the negotiating to save the money, or could the man in the estate agent get me a better deal? I mean, estate agents are great at putting deals together, and I must admit that when we bought our last flat, the estate agent actually negotiated money off for us, because he got the people who were selling to us a lower price for the property they were buying, which was a probate sale. Mm-hmm. So he negotiated money off further up the chain. So in that instance, he got the whole thing together and made sure it worked, and it was great. But if you look at the situation in London, you know, in recent months, we've had people queuing round the block bidding over the asking price. Well, I mean, why wouldn't you do it yourself online for £600? If demand, if there's that much demand, then I'm pretty sure you could sell your own home.
And also, estate agents will argue that because they're getting their commission at the end, they've got more of a motivation to sell the property, whereas online, you pay your flat fee up front. Where's that motivation to sell? You know, they've already got your custom, so where's that motivation to sell? That's the big thing that estate agents will say.
There is a very interesting point to be made here on two things. Firstly, estate agents' fees are not set in stone. So if an estate agent tells you that it will cost you 2% to sell your home, mm-hmm. and you do decide you want to use a high street estate agent, that 2% is negotiable. Now, how happy they are to negotiate on it will depend on all kinds of, you know, situations like how good the market is, how many properties they've got on. But they will negotiate on that fee. And what you can potentially do, which is what we did last time we sold a flat, was we tried to negotiate on the fee and they gave us a bit of money off and I said I wanted more off. Then the estate agent came back and said, well, actually, I'll tell you what, I'll make a suggestion. If we sell it for more than this price, we'll charge a slightly higher fee. If we sell it for less than this price, we'll charge this slightly lower fee. So actually, we put a line in the sand and said, well, you beat that, and then we'll give you the extra money for beating it. The second point is that estate agents make money from selling properties. Properties that are sat in the window that don't sell don't make them any money. In fact, they cost them money because they've had to pay all the marketing costs. So it's in their best interest to get a deal done. So when you think, oh, there's that property, but it's too expensive, oh, I don't really want to make an offer on it. People feel bad about making offers on properties. British are not very good at negotiating on things. Actually, the estate agents like you to make an offer because they then have to pass that on to the client. And in many instances, some of the properties that are overpriced are not because the estate agent has overvalued them, but because the person who owns them thinks they're worth more than they are. Or another agent has said, yeah, I'll get you £350 for that, because they want to get it on their books. And then eventually they have to cut the price down. And the only way that the estate agent can get the message through to their client that they've overpriced their property is by putting forward these offers, because they've already said to them, you won't sell it for £350, you'll only sell it for £320. But if they get three offers in at that price, then the client will realise they've overpriced it and the estate agent can start trying to put a deal together. So it's always worth making an offer.
Lee, there's plenty in the article here with Sarah Beeney about tips getting your house ready for sale.
Yeah, I think two real key ones. First one is photographs. The photographs have to be professional and they have to look good. I mean, this is an age of Instagram and everyone wants to look at photos, look good. If you advertise a property online and it doesn't look good in the photos, it's going to put people off. People are just simply not going to want to see it. So she a tip she was saying was to put something to offset the room, you know, a big bunch of flowers or something that gives it a bit of lift and makes it look bigger. And secondly, she was saying that wooden floors are now out. So there's been a real fad, I would say, the last turn of millennium, really. Strip out your carpets, polish up those old floors, old wooden floors. And it's been very much in trend. But she was saying that it's now going back to fitted carpets.
Fitted carpets are back in vogue,
Vogue, yeah. So the two reasons, she said, largely because of energy bills. So wooden floors do feel colder. They do let in more of a draft. And people are probably just a little bit more, you know, if you've got your feet on a cold wooden floor, it sort of does make you feel colder. So there's that aspect. And the other thing is acoustics. So if you live in a converted flat, a house that's been converted into flats, if they're all wooden floors, if you live on the bottom floor, you're going to have upstairs, you know, walking along, you're going to hear everything. And if they've got kids, you know, it's noisy. Wooden floors are pretty noisy. So that was what she was saying. Those two things are key at the moment.
We've got carpet in our bedrooms, actually. When we moved into our flat, we had wooden floors in there. Our flat is a maisonette, so it's the ground floor and the basement. And unfortunately, there was a damp problem. We had to have all the floors ripped up downstairs, which was extremely expensive. But when we redid it, we carpeted the floors in the bedroom because we decided that actually it was nicer to get out of bed onto a carpet under your feet. But then upstairs in the living areas, it's a wood floor. And I must admit, with two young kids, that pays off.
Yes. Kids, you've got to think about that. Well, let's stick with property for a second. In an article that you've written, Simon, on the buy-to-let market, also features on the This Is Money website. Now, we've actually touched on this issue already this week, getting some advice from buy-to-let expert and author David Lawrenson from the website Letting Focus. He told me more about the origins of this type of investment.
Well, buy-to-let is a term that came in 1996 with the advent of specialist mortgages for people to let out property with. and it was called the buy-to-let mortgages. So that phrase originally started in around 96. So it was a form of mortgage, and it's become synonymous with letting property. So people talk about letting property, they talk about buy-to-let, and so we all have to use the word buy-to-let. But originally, it was a term for the mortgages that came in around that time.
Do we still have those?
Yes, of course. We still have many buy-to-let mortgages, about 700 available on the market right now, I believe. Increasingly, over the last few months in particular, interest rates and fees on those are falling, and so there's quite a lot of there's certainly more choice than there was. Things got a bit difficult to get to buy-to-let mortgage back in the 2008, 2009, the credit crunch. But there's plenty around there.
Yeah, it's seen a bit of a resurgence, hasn't it, of late? Why is that?
What interest in buy-to-let?
Well, yes, I mean, obviously not quite the boom years that it was, but then we saw a significant dip, unsurprisingly, in the financial crash. It does seem to be we're seeing something of a resurgence now.
I think the reason is, I mean, people look at the money that they can make from savings in the bank. You know, you'd be do well to get to 2.5%, wouldn't you, really, on even a 5-year fixed term. Mm-hmm. So people looking at the alternative of investing in property, where, you know, there's potential for capital growth and decent yields. And increasingly people are looking at that. And with the changes coming into pensions next year, that will become of interest to people as well as at an older age level too. So increasingly more and more people becoming landlords. And I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon with what the things that are happening.
Just explain to us about the pensions freedoms that are going to come in and how that's going to impact, you think, on this market.
Well, you can take a chunk of money out of your pension when you retire from next April. And and the buy-to-let lenders, some of them are sort of recognising the potential there and are increasingly allowing people to be over the age of 65 when they apply to get a mortgage. And even, I think you can have a mortgage, still have one running when you're over 85, I think, even with one or two lenders. So they're recognising that opportunity that exists, and people thinking, OK, I've got this lump sum now, what can I do with it? Some of the money into a deposit on a buy-to-let property, and there's thought to be that there'll be quite a lot of people who will be doing this, and so a whole lot more landlords, grey-haired landlords, coming into the market.
Well, that was buy-to-let expert and author David Lawrenson there talking to me earlier from Letting Focus. Simon, tell us more about this buy-to-let article that you wrote and the advice that you're offering, the top 10 tips on buy-to-let.
This 10 tips for buy-to-let article was actually something that I originally wrote in 2006, and it's been updated regularly since then. This is one of the most popular stories on our site. That highlights the demand for buy-to-let. And what we've done is we've updated it as the market has changed, but the basic advice boils down to the same thing. And the reason why I wrote this is because I think there is a concern that there's a lot of people who plough into buy-to-let without really thinking about it too much. And that seriously damages the returns that you're going to make. And also, that's where a lot of the problems are created, where people get angry about landlords who aren't doing what they're meant to be doing and looking after their tenants. If you're going to be investing tens of thousands of pounds into the deposit for a property, then you want to make sure that you're doing all the things that can make sure it goes right. Mm-hmm. And these are really simple things, but certainly what we saw at the peak of the property boom, when there was a lot of money ploughing into this, is that people were just ignoring these simple things. It's about looking at who's the target market for this property? Who is going to be my tenant? Are they going to want to live in this location? Are they going to want to live in this property? Where can I add value to this property? How can I get the cheapest mortgage? Do I want to try and manage it myself and let it out myself, be a DIY landlord? Or do I want to use a letting agent? What is the actual return that I'm going to get on this? I mean, it's astonishing, actually, the number of sort of people who've become what they call accidental landlords or sort of part-time landlords who've never really considered the actual return that they're getting on their property once they've accounted for all the things they have to pay out for: mortgage costs, agent's fees, maintenance, upkeep. These are the absolute crucial things to making a good investment.
You can see why it's so popular, though, at the moment. Low savings rates, market volatility, et cetera, et cetera.
And a huge amount of the popularity in the first sort of first life stage of buy-to-let, maybe in its childhood and teenage years, was due to house prices rocketing in the early 2000s. And people were buying properties to let with, you know, relatively small deposits. and the price was jumping 50, 60%. And obviously, because you're putting down a deposit and you're borrowing the rest of the money on a mortgage, that's leverage and that magnifies your returns. So there were people buying a property for maybe £100,000 and making £50,000 off the back of it in a very short space of time. Now, that looks hugely attractive. Lots of people got drawn into this. There was a big boom in buy-to-let flats, people buying off plan, and a lot of those people got very badly burnt when the credit crunch hit. Since that sort of financial crisis, interest rates being cut to the bone, it started to look a lot more attractive from an income perspective. So, you know, interest rates are at 0.5%. A savings account is going to get you 1.5%, 2.5% at the moment. If you can rent a property out and theoretically the rental return is the equivalent of 5% a year, well, that looks very attractive, especially if you can hope for some steady capital growth over the years. And that's actually a much better way of looking at investing in property, is that that income gives you the steady return and you pick up a bit of capital growth along the way.
So if you are thinking of buy to let, top 10 tips for buy to let, the essential advice for property investors and pick of the top mortgage rates by Simon Lambert on thisismoney.co.uk/money.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Now, Simon and reporter Lee Boyce, we turn our attention to the third story, which is something you've been looking into for quite some time now. This is about Lloyds Bank and how it's been hassling their customers. Can we say that word? This story emerged following allegations made by the Daily Mail last month, which exposed that members of staff at Lloyds Bank have been flouting laws designed to protect customers. Lee, can you tell me about this?
Yeah, sure. So actually, it was back in June. I've got quite a few whistleblowers that are staff that work in branches. Now, I was told things have changed there again. So they've always had sales targets the last few years. They now call them customer needs met, which I think is quite quite an interesting term. But as part of this customer needs met, they have to make cold calls now. So they're having to...
So customer needs met is a sales target. It's not meeting
target.
Customers'
well,
needs.
Well, they'll say something otherwise, but it's sales targets, okay, essentially. And as part of this now, they're having to make cold calls before work and after work. So I've been told there's 20 calls that they have to make. Now, people will have opted out of marketing calls and will have TPS systems as well. So, you know, these are the people.
TPS?
It's telephone preference service. So mm-hmm. They don't want to get nuisance calls, basically. And these are nuisance calls, really. You know, I think they're nuisance calls. Selling savings accounts, loans, and other stuff that will help build up targets. And what's happened this week is the Treasury Select Committee have said, stop calling these customers that have a flag on their account. So they'll have a flag on their account, and the staff are actively told by their management to call the customers even if they don't want to call.
So it's essentially like when you sign up to something and it says, if you do not want to be contacted by us, tick this box or untick this box.
Exactly.
Or any
and
wording
customers would have done it when they've opened current accounts in branch or mortgages. You know, just some people just don't. We get phone calls all the time from PPI, you know, spam calls and all that sort of stuff. The last thing you want is a phone call from your bank in the evening when you come home from work trying to flog you a savings account, which, you know, isn't earning the top rate anyway. There's better rates out there. So
if the savings account was that good, they probably wouldn't be ringing you up and telling you
exactly
about it.
Well, you've got to wonder that. Well, in the hearing you did say there, Treasury Select Committee Conservative MP Mark Garnier described the bank's conduct as a pretty sorry story. Well, earlier this week we had personal finance expert Sarah Pennells from the Savvy Woman website here in the studio, and she spoke to me about how banks are currently operating and how much they seem to care about customer satisfaction.
I think that they do need to, in everything they do, and it's whether it's dealing with complaints, which, I mean, earlier on this mm-hmm. week, the financial regulator was saying that not just banks, but financial firms generally need to think about customers at the centre of their complaints. As you say, there were fines last week. And I think that what this shows is exactly what the regulator, the FCA, is trying to stop, which is that there was this sort of signing off box ticking mentality rather than taking a holistic view of what they're doing. Now, whether that is making sure their IT systems are up to standard and able to deliver what customers want. And on the other hand, acting in a way that consumers can have faith in, not just that their payments will be made, but that the bank is kind of got them at the heart of what they're doing. And this is something that we do hear regularly now from the banks. I mean, they're kind of almost sort of elbowing each other out of the way to say that they get it. You know, they understand what customers want. They're learning from their mistakes.
Well, so what have Lloyds been saying then?
Well, Lloyd's got grilling from MPs this week over this. This is where the story this week came from. Their Director of Customer Service, Martin Dodd, insisted that the bank was providing good service, describing these as courtesy calls and the sort of things banks should be doing, but pressed on allegations staff were pressured by managers to make these nuisance calls. He said, where there is any kind of pressure, that is unacceptable. The Director of Mortgages, Stephen Noakes, said the bank had banned branch staff, from making these phone calls. So he says, so now we have stopped those calls. We don't do those calls. And a Lloyds spokesman said, we would not call a customer who is registered on the telephone preference service. And if any customers believe that they are registered and have been contacted in error, we would recommend that they contact us to ensure their preferences have been recorded correctly.
Yeah. But, what have your readers been saying?
Well, what our readers have been saying, and this is interesting because these are not just our readers. These are not just the people being cold called. In fact, we've got quite a few comments here from people who say they worked for Lloyds. You know, Lee's been reporting this story for a number of years and following this, and he's had a number of whistleblowers of people who work for Lloyds. So I've got here a comment from Red Beans in Wolverhampton, who says, I resigned from Lloyds because they sold to clients who had no need for the product. It was all about military-style targets and bonus. He also said, as a recent member of staff, I'm able to confirm this story is 100% true. Salesmen flout rules and call these customers very often to get sales points. The only aim is to sell a product. Point out, that's just his comment. The select committee needs to call back the directors or senior staff and ask them why they have lied. There's been a massive campaign by Lloyds directors to break rules and to get sales from cold calling. Now, obviously, as I pointed out, that's just a comment from someone who claims to have previously been a member of staff. But another person appears to confirm that, a chap called Right No Left. Lloyds have changed their terminology again and now call selling helping the customer. Change from meeting customers' needs. Obviously, this has been enough to fool everyone. Final comment here. This is Blue Moon in Peterborough. He says, one best way whiteboards are found on the back of office walls of every Lloyds branch detailing the hourly, daily, weekly, quarterly sales and service targets. They are reviewed every 2 hours by the manager to check individual performance. Those staff not achieving their target are subject to intimidation with the threat of improvement plans and or disciplinary action.
That's been a common theme throughout the years that I've investigated, you know, claims from whistleblowers in Lloyds. And I actually spoke to one on the phone yesterday, and just over 1,000 jobs have been cut before Christmas. So staff morale is very low, is what I've been told, and 9,000 staff, 200 branches are going in the next 3 years. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I don't envy people that have to work there at the moment.
It's interesting, we're talking about it being a nuisance, obviously, for people receiving those calls, but what's coming through quite loud and clear is what it's like to work in that environment.
Indeed, yeah, it can't be pleasant, and that's what I've been told.
It cuts back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, about, you know, this low-wage environment where people have not had wage rises, there's a lot of people moving into lower-paid jobs out of higher-paid jobs. These people are very worried about their jobs. They're worried that they might be the next people to be cut. So when they are told to make these calls, they make these calls. And I can't imagine it's a lot of fun calling someone up and saying, this is just a courtesy call, and then trying to flog them a load of stuff to someone who's trying to eat their dinner or watch the television.
Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money, and journalist Lee Boyce from the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Thank you very much for joining us live in the studio. Simon, just remind how people can get in contact if they have any comments they'd like to make on this, or if they want any stories for you to investigate.
Well, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at This Is Money. And also, if you go to thisismoney.co.uk, we've got all of our contact details there. You can get in touch with any of our reporters. So we'd love to hear from you.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.